Okay, before we get started, Leslie Croft is going to make some announcements. First of all, for anyone here who's interested in the interest following course, you can actually, it is actually, apparently, they say, possible to register for this course today. So it's Math 606, Section 101.
It's not working.
It's not working. Well, okay. This does not surprise me. However, the information was given to me usually by our usual sources with the usual degree of reliability is that today it's possible to register over the web. So not yesterday, but today. Math 606, Section 101. In any event, it will be possible to use paper, drop out, and so on. Over the next couple of days. So if these problems are not straightened out, they'll eventually get straightened out somehow. Okay, also for this seminar, he asked me to give you a bit of advance warning as to what's coming. So next week at this time, we'll have a few introductions in which new faculty and postdocs introduce themselves. So just give very, very short, informal introductions. So unless you've twisted your arm sufficiently hard. So next week we'll have Alana Fraser and Stephen Gustafson and Haiping Tsai. Then the week after that, Brian, are you? So you're actually the person who's physically speaking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So Brian Wenton will speak about some work of his with Roger Donaldson on basically a moving boundary problem. I guess the boundary problem is actually stationary in this case.
It's one of these things where we know that there's some interest from the application, but we don't even know what the math is called. So I'm hoping you guys can help out with that.
Okay, so we have a naming party in 2 weeks. The week after that, we'll continue with more introductions, I guess, Marshall. I don't know who else that's too far in the future for a reliable prediction anyway. Hey, so today we're happy to have with us Walter Craig. Now a CRC at McMaster, Brown before then, and he's going to talk about traveling waterways.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation to come, and I'm growing hoarse since I've been speaking math from dawn to dusk ever since Sunday morning. Let's start here. First off, I have a transparency, which is in honor of the Pacific Rim nature of this university. So my title is Traveling Water Waves. I want to talk about... I'm going to move this over there and put the new one on here, so you'll have a very close chance. And this is work that started with the PhD thesis of Dave Nichols. Has carried on over the last couple of years. He's moved from Brown to Minnesota and just started at Notre Dame. And I have apologies to Ilana, who might have heard bits of this before. Okay, so... Oh, and I wanted to explain the woodcut. This is a Japanese woodcut from the classical era, between mid-1700s to mid-1800s. This is by Hiroshige. The nice version I got from the web is at the British Museum. He makes a refreshing change from the Hokusai, the Great Wave, in his 100 views of Mount Fuji. So this is Hiroshige's 36 views of Mount Fuji. I mean, that's still Mount Fuji in the distance. But I like it, one, because it's a little different. That one, the old one, Hokusai was getting a little cloying. And two, it has these patterns in the foreground, which I like very, very much, and I want you to see more of them. And I guess the third thing about it is that you probably all know Hokusai from The Great Wave, but You probably also know Hiroshige, because he was the he was known to the Impressionists, and in fact Van Gogh made copies of several of Hiroshige's woodcuts. The most famous one, I guess, is the Ohashi Bridge in the Rain. It's a dramatic bridge across with the rain pelting down, and then that's a known Van Gogh. Anyway, enough art history. Hiroshige lived 1797 to 1858, and this is in fact a woodcut that he made in 1858. So I want to talk about water. I want to talk about Euler's equations. So I'm going to give you the equations, the starter, you know, for start. And so first, the fluid domain is two or three. Well, actually, we're mathematicians. It can be an n-dimensional domain, n bigger than zero, and actually n bigger than two, because I want it to have depth and horizontal extent. I'm going to be a member of the Flat Earth Society for this talk. So it's an infinite flat sea. So we could do it on the globe, but well, let's not for this talk. I didn't for this talk. And I wanted to make it also infinite depth, constant at minus h. Topography would be allowed in general, but maybe not for my purposes of this talk. And then I want to find a fluid motion, which will be given by a velocity vector field u in the fluid domain, and a free surface. And I drew that in blue, sort of, you know, blue, the water. And the problem is to find the velocity vector field u and the free surface, blue. And what I'll do is, so maybe it's not so good for this campus, because I'm not going to allow surf. I'm going to make sure that, at least for my solutions, like not that, I'm going to have single-valued functions when parameterized by, so I'm going to give surfaces as a graph. And that's what is y is equal to eta of x and t. X is the two horizontal, or the n minus one horizontal variables. The nth variable in the equation is y. And it'll depend on time. And so it's our problem to find the evolution of the surface. That's what we see when the sea surface moves. And the velocity vector field u. Now, let me tell you what Euler's equations are. That's the fluid domain. Just let me tell you what the equations are. Well, I don't want, the fluid is, water is very almost incompressible, so let's make it incompressible. That's the model. So it doesn't, as it moves, it doesn't change its volume, therefore divergence-free vector field. Let's also simplify the full Euler problem by saying I also want a curl-free vector field. And that's an additional assumption, and not always true, but it's pretty good for, say, the inlet here off campus. It's not very good behind a ship's propeller, and it's not very good if you take into account all of the North Atlantic, because that's now really has to be on the sphere, and their Coriolis forces and other things. But it's not bad for, well, what I've been saying is it's not bad for Lake Ontario. But I guess I used to say it's not bad for Narragansett Bay. But I guess since I'm on sabbatical in Berkeley, it's not bad for the San Francisco Bay either. Let me stop telling stories and do something. Excuse me. These are compatibility conditions for u to be a gradient of a function phi, and then this states that function is harmonic. So I'm really just looking for harmonic functions, a very well-known problem. So what's the difficulty? On the bottom, it's a solid bottom. I don't want any flow into the bottom, so the vector field, when it's at the bottom, has to be tangential. There's no normal component. That says Neumann conditions on the bottom, also very well-known. What's the big deal? The big deal is the boundary conditions on the free surface. So those are two. One, you have to find the velocity potential. Two, you have to find the surface itself. So the count is right. And let me put these up a little bit. And this is a geometrical condition saying the surface is advected with the velocity field on the surface. And this has the physics. And it basically says there are the restoring forces due to gravity, due to inertia, and also due to surface tension. Differential changes in the area of the surface, for molecular reasons, supply a restoring force in the sea, very small, in other fluids, or depending on which scale you choose, could be bigger. And I wouldn't put it in except I need it for the theorem. So, or what can you say? It's also a physical effect. I'd like to solve it without that, but it's an open problem. I'll touch upon that as we go along. Anyway, give you a chance. That makes it so I'm not rushing through my slides, and it's easier to take notes. So, just let me go through the notation again. G is the acceleration of gravity. Sigma was the strength of the surface tension. Sigma over GH squared is what you usually say. It's a non-dimensional number, which is called the Bond number. Also, determines the strength of surface tension. That H I had in that slide is the mean curvature of the surface. And I specifically want to allow, and H is the little h is the depth, and I want to specifically allow any depth from zero. I can't be equal to zero because I need some water to work with, but any depth from positive h all the way and including infinity. Can it be an infinite depth? C. Sorry? Surface tension over gh squared depends on the depth. Bond number turns out to... The Bond number... The same fluid changes the depth, the Bond number changes. That's the way it is. And then, what are my boundary conditions? Well, those change per problem. Today I want to talk about periodic boundary conditions. So again, we're in the Flat Earth Society, infinite extent. I'm going to look for wave patterns which are periodic, determined by, well, if I were an oceanographer, I want the problem to tell me what the period it was. But I'm a mathematician, I'm going to have the luxury of I specify the period. It fixes the problem. And just to say that, I want the surface to look the same under translation by any point in a lattice. Oh, let me just go through this again. This is R and N minus 1. These are the X's. There are horizontal translations. I have a lattice. Any translation of the lattice preserves the surface. And then the potential obeys the same thing, except, you know, potentials aren't physical quantities. Their gradients are. So there's this extra constant, the extra term which goes along, which is the usual thing when dealing with potentials. I'm going to even further specialize. Eta and phi, eta in general is a function of x and t. But I want to look at solutions which are steady in the proper frame. So I want to. So part of the problem is to find C. So this means so a solution which depends only on the combination x minus tc is, of course, a solution such that if I fly over it in a helicopter moving horizontally at velocity c, then it's stationary. Then it doesn't change. And presumably there's not making wind on the water to screw it up. But whatever. And then, again, the potential changes in a standard way. And my nomenclature, just to make sure that we're talking about the same problem, when x is in one real-dimensional space, it's a two-dimensional problem because there's x and there's depth y. When x is in two dimensions, it's x1, x2 is the horizontal extent and y. And then when x is in n minus one dimensions, we're studying the n-dimensional problem. And really, this is a theorem in three and higher dimensions, but three is the relevant one. So, now I can state, have all the vocabulary to state the main theorem, which is in dimension 2, with any surface tension, including zero surface tension, choose any lattice, then there exist solutions of equation 1. Well, any lattice in one dimension, and x is in one dimension, any lattice means just choose a wavelength. So in any wavelength, there are going to be non-trivial solutions. And the theorem continued is in dimensions bigger than or equal to 3, any surface tension, but I don't allow zero. So I needed it on my first slide, my second slide. For any lattice of horizontal translations, there exist solutions of equation 1. And then you could argue, well, that's kind of a trivial theorem because zero is a solution, and indeed it is. So really the inner part of this theorem is that there are non-trivial solutions, and I want to describe the solution sets. Okay? And it's a bifurcation problem for traveling waves. And it turns out, how about sigma equals zero when n is 3 or higher? Turns out that this is Well, you know, when you're in your helicopter flying with the right speed, this is a problem that is stationary. There's no time involved anymore. Nonetheless, the analog of the small divisor problem is present, even though it's simply an elliptic, nonlinear, oblique boundary value problem. This still has small divisors like a dynamical system, like a Hamiltonian dynamical system. And this is what drew me to the problem. But to tell you the truth, I haven't solved that yet. It's still open. But the structure is the same. So this talk is about a problem which is maybe approaching that one, if you're an optimist. Okay, and then let's count our parameters. Part of the solution is c, the velocity at which the solution travels, the horizontal velocity at which the solution travels. And that's in two dimensions. X is one dimension, is one horizontal direction. And so you have one dimensional parameter, just c, the speed. And when n is equal to 2, that's one parameter. Solutions curve in one parameter families, bifurcation curves. Sort of the count, one parameter, one-dimensional curves. And what seems to be completely obvious, although seems to be also missed in the literature, is that when n is equal to 3, and you can imagine there's a huge amount of literature, when n is equal to 3, there are two horizontal directions, and you have to solve for two components of the horizontal velocity, and solutions arise in bifurcation surfaces, and you have to find, that's part of the problem, is to find those surfaces. So now I have to carry on to tell you about the theorem. That was my plan, at least. But before we do that, why don't we just look at some pictures of such solutions? So here's one picture. This was published by Sue, Bergen, Marler, and Myrick in Journal of Fluid Mechanics, 1982. And it's a wave basin in Tennessee whose name has slipped my mind. The facility of the names that my mind, and what they do is they push a long paddle, which is just a plank, basically, at some far end down here, and it's this thing which is, I don't know, a half an acre of water or something. It's really quite big. And then that creates a wave with just almost two-dimensional, because almost constant in this at the plank, but then that breaks up. There's an instability. It breaks up, and then it makes, in the middle of that motion, makes these beautiful staggered pattern of horseshoes of crescent-shaped crests alternating between here and here and here. Here, this is behind, I think this is behind this. This is supposed to go like that. Anyway, it's this gorgeous pattern.
How sensitive are these things to boundary conditions? Presumably it's not periodic boundary conditions that we have.
Good question. I don't know. If you set the tank so that the motion, so that the wall of the tank is perfectly in line with the plane of symmetry, so that all the, every velocity vector field, if the wall were not there, were tangent to this plane, then doesn't not sensitive at all, except for a little viscosity on the wall. I'll tell you what happens here is this is a big pond, and they move the plank in the middle of it. And then the ends of the pond, they don't move. And the wave goes forward, leaving a little bit of stuff. And then this pattern forms some tens of meters down from the plank, and at or after the pattern forms, it sends up important amount of things outside that region. That's interesting. It, that pattern created the stuff, which, and that's another discussion, but it's not part of this talk. So that's part of lunch. So here's, I don't know, I find these very nice. 1982, I don't know these people, but I know these people. We did this, and this is not an experiment. This is by Hammack, Joe Hammack and Diane Henderson at Penn State in 2000. There's the date, August 2000. We're in a focused research group together, and this is one of our meetings where we got together to talk about things. And they're mathematicians who have wave tanks in their department. It's kind of cool. So not that I'm recommending a wave tank for every department, but you know, it makes it unique there. And the glue had just dried on their big 3D wave tank. This is several meters by several meters. And this is about, this is depth, 25 centimeters. So that's quarter of a meter. And the glue had just dried. And this is not an experiment. The glue had just dried, and they had, yesterday, and they filled it up and said, let's try it out. And let's see, this blue bar has a line of paddles on it. This is a, oh, I have to explain what the picture is. This is, this white is the bottom of the tank. This thing with a few streaks on it is the glass, which keeps the water from getting us, this is the side of the tank. It keeps the water from getting us wet. And this line is the edge of the water against the side of the tank. And this is what keeps us from falling in. And that blue paddles hang from it, and those are what generate it, and then waves are supposed to move down this tank. Well, they have 32 paddles, but they only had 8 running. So they put an I-beam in, so it didn't bother the rest of them. And then the paddles were there and said, oh, let's just turn them on to do anything. So we just had them go like this. I mean, that's why I said it's not an experiment. It's, gee, let's try out the new toy. And lo and behold, and then they have a camera. Lo and behold, out came a pattern. And the pattern has hexagons in these flight patterns. And I find that also gorgeous. Just do anything and these patterns appear. You'd expect it. And of course, then they go down to the end of the tank and something happens to them down there. So, this is more of an experiment. Same facility a year later. So this was last year. And the lights are off and they have backlighting that makes the measurement very dramatic. They actually have quantitative measurements by other means, which they should talk about, not me. But again, you see this. Now these are quite long crests, and you see this beautiful, effectively, well, I don't know, it has a hexagonal character to it. There are cells, they are staggered. Here are some periodic patterns. And here is the waveform is designed so it's the velocity field is tangent to the edge of the tank. Otherwise, there would be too much reflection. What's the crest size?
Exactly, but more or less.
Yeah, because you like to say, what's a measurement somehow of the nonlinearity in the problem?
Yeah.
I'd say they are like. So if this is 2 meters and they're half, 1, 2, 3. So there are 4 of them. So this is about half a meter, and I'd say this is maybe between 10 and 20 centimeters, and this is maybe 4 or 5. So a slope of a quarter, a half. Slope is an important feature, something important that these people measure. So slope is 0.3, 0.26. I don't know the details.
No.
And I think if we look on their website, we could click down below this and actually find the details. Actually, I'm not sure they're public, but they give me the URL, and I think I could. So if you wanted, we could explore that. Here's some computations of Dave Nichols. He was my collaborator on this. This is a deep water case. This is numerical. It's supposed to look like those offset linear rolling, you know, rolling pattern as the previous slide. And now it's a big affair to lower it to make shallow water, deep water, to change that in a tank, but it's a very easy affair on a computer. Oh, I was going to give the... We should have filled this up, but if you just look here, that's the contour plot of those solutions. And they have that, this is a trough, this is a crest. So they have that, this is one wavelength, and they have the offset picture that I was showing you in the previous ones. But you can dial down the depth. And how do they change? Here's a contour plot. One depth is depth H is 1/100. That one was depth effectively infinity. That was depth that was comparable to what the tank was. And they get long and very hexagonal. I find that a gorgeous plot. But I'm just showing you examples, so I'm not really going to talk a huge amount about that. So back to the theorems on the subject. I don't want to bore you with the history of the thing. It's a problem with a lot of history, and I could fill the rest of the time just talking about who did what perturbations of what. So I don't want to do that, but I thought I surely should mention precedents, and I just, what I chose to put on the slide is who proved a theorem in a certain setting for existence. It has a venerable history dating to Levi-Civita in 2 dimensions. No surface tension, infinite depth. He introduced complex variables techniques. And they're very beautiful. and they have been extremely influential, and they only have the one fault, which is it's very hard to do them in three and higher dimensions. But Dirk Strouk was a postdoc with him at that time, and this was published in Math Annalen, and this was also published in Math Annalen a year later, and he did the finite depth case. Again, it's similar, complex variables, mappings to a disk, so you, in some sense, bound your... You fix the domain. The domain is no longer working, and you look for a solution which is a conformal, conformal mapping. Zeidler introduced surface tension, but needed the bond number to be large, and that's in 71. It's effectively a 45-year jump. Oh, I forgot Nekrasov, who wrote in an obscure journal in, I guess it was a house journal in Novosibirsk. Same thing as Levi-Civita in 1921, but it wasn't known. And then I only fairly recently learned of it. And then people at Madison republished it in their Madison preprint series in 67, just to have it out there. Or maybe they translated it and published it. In any case, it's a disconnect between the East and the West. Zeidler did this in 71. Tom Beale was allowed to lower his bond number anywhere, but it's important to get below one-third. But he needed it non-resonant. So part of the talk is I'm going to say what resonant is. But it's like having multiplicity of an eigenvalue. And then the thing is about two dimensions is it's either an isolated eigenvalue or it can have multiplicity, but at most two. And Jones and Tolland did the multiplicity two case. Those are called by the engineers Wilton ripples. Three dimensions, not so much is known. So Reeder and Shinbrot spent certainly the latter part of his career in Victoria. That's a local connection. They studied the three-dimensional problem with positive surface tension on special domains. And let's see if I can... He said, well, one, they needed specifically non-resonant, and two, their domains looked like this. So I'm going to make the direction of propagation this, and I'm going to also call this. So C is like this, and this is going to be X1, and this is X2. And what his domains look like are things that look like this, so that if I reflect in X1, I get the same picture. And what it means is it's like a wave reflecting off a wall. And so the fundamental domain looks a bit like that. It's the domain of a wave reflecting off a wall. And now I just want to remind Dave Bridges that we were walking in Stanley Park and the cruise ships were leaving and waves from their wake were impinging on that little stone wall that's right on the shore and reflecting and making nice lozenge patterns, and we were looking at them. And I just wanted to remember that's this case, more or less. Sun improved that. Groves and Mielke used their particular techniques to find rectangular domains. So that's not symmetric diamond, but it's rectangles. I'm talking about the present work, any case, all cases. Need positive surface tension, as all these people need. And I also want to point out that when you impose this special symmetry, you get curves of solutions, and these are surfaces. Open problem, sigma equals zero. I don't think I'm going to spend that much time talking about the small divisor problem, but maybe in the end I'll say again why it's enticing and what people maybe could do or cannot do. Okay, let's get to work. It turns out this is a Hamiltonian system, and sometimes that's an interesting statement, sometimes that's just a throwaway statement. But here I'm going to use it to count solutions. It's important for the ultimate count of multiplicity of distinct solutions. So I wanted to explain it to you, and it has its own charm. So let's make the fluid domain X in Rn minus 1 mod gamma, so that's a torus, an n minus 1 dimensional torus, and Y going from the bottom to the free surface. And then we all can write down what the energy should be. So energy has to be a sum of half the velocity squared. Density is set to 1. That's the kinetic energy. The potential energy, we can derive this at lunch over a napkin. This is the gravitational potential energy. And then surface tension is really a proportionality constant times differential increase of surface area. So it's due to the, it's the variation of the differential increase in surface area. That's what gives you mean curvature. Let's do the momentum while we're doing it. That's the energy. Let's do the momentum. The momentum in the jth x direction, so j in three-dimension problem, there are going to be two x's. There's momentum 1, momentum in direction 2, is equal to the sum everywhere of the velocity times the mat, the density, which is 1. And if you just integrate by parts, it's a surface integral, phi minus phi, xj derivative of eta. And so that's easy. What's subtle is, what are the canonical... So you can have a Hamiltonian, but you don't know the coordinates. So what Zaharov told us is, what are the canonical conjugate variables? And they are eta, which maybe is guessable, but xi, which is subtle. And that is the boundary values of the harmonic function. So it's phi, its values on the boundary. And if you write that down, then you write Euler's equations, which are the same as, which are the analog of, which are equivalent to the equations I had on about six slides ago, the full equations of motion, Laplace's equation and all, and that goes as follows. Eta dot is equal to the xi variation of h, and xi dot is equal to minus the eta variation of h. And then, to tell you the truth, this Zaharov's picture is very beautiful and straightforward. So in any case, this is Hamiltonian form. Z dot is equal to j grad h of z. But it was argued over for, well, it's a 68 paper. It's argued over for 30 years. I think people are still arguing over it. Although, my next slide, you know, after this and my next slide, it should be absolutely perfectly clear to everyone in the room. For one, you have to take the Hamiltonian, which has phi, the Dirichlet integral, and differentiate it with respect to its boundary data. And secondly, you have to take the Hamiltonian, where it has a domain defined by this function eta, and differentiate it with respect to eta. So it has a certain subtlety. Anyway, it's always good to have discussion. So how am I going to... So problem 1, not even problem 0, if I'm going to use this, how to make it a little bit more explicit, its dependence on... the Hamiltonian's dependence on the variables that you chose. So I'm going to do that via the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. So I'm going to call it G for various reasons. And remember, again, I have boundary data phi, which is... So xi, which is the boundary data of phi, is the boundary values of the velocity potential. And then the boundary value... So if I'm given a domain, so if I'm given eta, I'm given a domain, and then I'm given xi, the boundary data on that domain, that parameterizes the solutions to the Laplace's equation. It's a Laplace solve. Right? So you make a harmonic extension to the domain, and on the bottom boundary you had to solve Neumann conditions. And then you take the gradient of that harmonic extension, you dot the normal, and to normalize the whole thing, not to normal on the free surface, and to normalize the whole thing, this d surface area is equal to, by definition, g of eta xi dx. And if I do that, g of eta turns out to be a self-adjoint operator. And it's pretty clear, once you're given the domain, it's a linear problem in xi. And it's also pretty clear, once you've been given the domain, it's kind of nonlinear and a little bit hard to parameterize how it depends on eta. Nonetheless, so hence part of the argument. And nonetheless, if you do that, then you can rewrite the Hamiltonian. And this I did with Catherine Soulem in a 93 paper. And we did other stuff, but in any case, this, which says that h is now equal to, what you do. You integrate by parts, you get a normal derivative on the boundary, and you replace it by, and that's what the Dirichlet-Neumann operator is. So it's quadratic form in xi, because its derivative is linear. But it has eta dependence in the domain from here, gravitational potential, and the surface area. And then Euler's equations, again, are rewritten. This. Eta dot is equal to the xi variation of h, which is now clear, it's got to be the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. And xi dot is equal to, this is still interesting, the eta variation of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. But at least it's expressible. And now just a few details before I go on. That operator, G. It takes one derivative. So it takes a Sobolev space with one derivative to a Sobolev space with no derivatives, say L2. It turns out to be analytic as you take it, as you move eta. So it's analytic in eta as long as eta is in C1. Well, that was proved by Koifman-Meyer for this and for a class of other operators when n is equal to 2, and actually you can make this Lipschitz in 1985. But higher dimensions is a little harder, and there's a paper by Christ and Jornet which proved a basic estimate for n greater than or equal to 3, which then we used to show that result. Well, that's harmonic analysis. Let's moving on from there just to say, what does it look like? Well, if it's analytic, one way to say that it has a convergent Taylor expansion. What are the Taylor polynomials? So let me just say, here's the zeroth one. There's no eta dependence. Here's the first one. It's concatenation of functions which depend on derivatives, so more Fourier multiplier operators, and multiplication. And G2, G3 are equally explicit, but increasingly complicated. But what I want to say is you can handle them.
Does G satisfy some kind of Riccati equation in
eta? It does. It's a very cool fact, which is a restatement in this form of the variational formula of Adamar. But, and again, I have to put that off till after lunch. Thanks. That's a very good comment. It's a very beautiful fact. It's a Riccati equation where it's d by d eta of G equals
so
something or other.
You can use that now in your...
We use it. Maybe a little implicitly, but we use it. Okay, so back to traveling wave solutions, which is what we're after. Remember, the form of a traveling wave solution is a function of x minus tc, and c also is going to be in form of x minus tc, and therefore, these solutions, they satisfy a more complicated differential equation, but they also satisfy d by dt of this is equal to minus c dot d by dx of this because of this form. And I want to point out that c dot j variation of the momentum, where there's two components of the momentum, 1 and 2, and so the c has two components. The dot is with that, and j is because it's a Hamiltonian vector field. And you substitute into that equation, this equation, that into this, and switch the side and the signs around, and you get this equation. And now I have to satisfy this. Now I have to solve this, and then you write this out because this is domain variations, etc. And this is, you write it out, and it looks kind of daunting. So all this stuff and the green stuff only vanishes when n is equal to 2, but it's still there when n is. It has to do with the gradient of eta, gradient c, or parallel or not. Anyway, it doesn't look so great, but as I wrote on the bottom of the slide, it's very simple. It's very simple conceptually, and that's what I want to do. So, write the equation down again. It has the following form, just from reading off that slide. The variation of h minus c dot the variation with respect to the momentum variables equals 0, where this is C1 dot variation I1 plus C2 dot variation I2, etc. And so, actually, it's a bit kind of a busy slide, and I'm running out short on time. So instead of reading all that to you, I'm just going to say what it means, which is think of the configurations A to C in some Sobolev space in which we'll do our analysis as our phase space. And I want to think of the set of maps of two torus, because it's going to be a two-dimensional surface, a two tori into that phase space, and I have to satisfy an equivariance condition. And then what I want to do is constrain that all those maps, each map is going to have a well-defined momentum. So it has a well-defined first component of the momentum and a well-defined second component of the momentum. So I want to constrain that set of maps. So a set of maps I'll call X. And the phase, constrain that set of maps so that the first momentum has value A, 1, and the second momentum, and the n-1th momentum has the value of A, n. So you can make n-1 constraints. I'm thinking in my mind n is equal to 3, so it's two constraints. So then this is M is a subvariety. It's not bounded above nor below, etc. It's a very complicated non-compact subvariety, not so complicated, but non-compact subvariety in the space of all mappings of codimension 2, because I made two constraints. And now I take H and I look for critical points on M. And a critical point on M satisfies a Lagrange multiplier rule, which is exactly that. So on M, find critical points. And comment, the topology of M influences the number of critical points of H on M. So, I'd like to pause and give you an analogy. And that analogy has nothing to do with PDE. It's a Lyapunov center theorem. Lyapunov's paper was in 1907, published in the Annals of Toulouse. And then Alan Weinstein published a very beautiful generalization of it, which was then generalized by Jürgen Moser. So let's go through that theorem. It's a separate theorem. Phase space. I want to now just make R2n my phase space, and I'm going to look at Z in phase space, which is QP, and a Hamiltonian system. QP dot is equal to J grad H. For the theorem, I guess you need H is equal to C3 or maybe a little bit less. Well, I mean, we're in the analytic category anyway. And I just want 0 to be a stationary point. So grad H at 0, 0, and I want it to be a center. And that could be a number of things, but I'm going to be even. And this is not the hypotheses of Weinstein nor Moser, but I'm just making it simple for us all. So I'm going to have H to be positive definite, so it looks like the bottom of a potential well there. And that will force the spectrum of the linear Hamiltonian system to be pure imaginary and pure imaginary pairs. And those eigenvalues are the frequencies. And Lyapunov's question are there periodic... So that means that this Hamiltonian system... Oh, so you linearize this Hamiltonian system at zero, and there are many periodic orbits. At least one family, one linear, one plane of solutions, eigenspace of solutions, for each frequency, if not more. And Lyapunov's question, are there periodic solutions of the nonlinear problem nearby the stationary point with frequency nearby the frequencies of the linear problem? And Lyapunov's answer was yes, if it satisfied non-resonant conditions. And Alan Weinstein's answer is yes, point. At least one for each frequency. So let me say it a little bit more precisely. Consider the space X, same name for spaces as that slide, that's I'm trying to make the analogy clear, AS of mappings of a circle, not a torus, a circle into phase space, which is R2n. And now that mapping has an action. So I of S, if this is sufficiently smooth, like C1 or H a half even will do. So you have I of S is equal to the integral over the circle of Q dot Q dp. So it's Q dp dt dt. And focus, and then do the following thing. Don't look at all mappings in S. Only look at those mappings in S, in X. Don't look at all mappings in S. Look at the mappings in X such that has fixed action. And to tell you the truth, this is not the way Alan Weinstein stated it. He fixed the Hamiltonian. He fixed the energy. I spoke in front of Alan more or less the same talk a few days ago and had to make that apology. It's not his theorem, but it's essentially his theorem. So fix the action and then look for critical points of H bar. And his theorem is, for small actions, each surface contains at least n. And so n degrees of freedom, n distinct periodic orbits on each iso-action surface, that's the right count. And I wanted to say the following, which is going to be crucial for our next, for that result, is orbits are critical points of H bar, which is the average Hamiltonian over the mapping. And the functions H bar and I are invariant under a circle action. It's kind of trivial. It seems like cheating to make progress from something so simple. But if I have one mapping of a circle, I can always translate the origin, and I mean, I haven't modded out by that possibility in here. And so under translation, under that, that's a, just changing the origin is a circle action. It leaves H bar invariant and an H I invariant, so it leaves M invariant. And so when you find a critical point of H, you find a whole circle of critical points. So you're looking for a critical orbit. But that circle action is somehow entangles M. It makes topology, mod out by that makes topology on M. And that count N, this number N, is from that count. It uses that fact. It's like saying the complex projective, it's like the projective space CPN is topologically more complicated than the sphere S2n-1. One has one more dimension than the other, and one is the quotient of the other by the circle action. So we have to decide, so I mean now I have to get back to water waves. And we have to decide what our frequencies are. So let's do linear theory. And I just have to, just so nobody's restless, I have to count the number of slides I have. This, I really have about 3, maybe 4 more slides. So to linear theory, we have to get the frequencies right, so let's linearize the equation. So just take the equation, linearize it, which is this, and I want to know, do I have zero, I want to know what's the null space. What do I have zero solutions of this? So just to study it, you take a Fourier basis. This is a Fourier transform of those multiply periodic functions, eta and xi. And I had to know the Dirichlet-Neumann operator based on this basis, and I forgot e to the I to the x here, sorry. And then theorem about the homogeneous solutions, when sigma is positive, the linear equation 8 has at most a finite dimensional set of solutions. That is, the null space is finite dimensional. We're going to call the null space X1, subset of X. It's a, for symplectic reasons, it's always even dimensional. And one of the problems when sigma is equal to zero is it could be infinite. And even if it isn't infinite, the spectrum which is not exactly zero but close to zero is, what do you mean? It has spectrum which always accumulates at zero. That doesn't happen with positive surface tension. And we can, you know, it's not a big theorem, and we're going to prove it ourselves by saying, let's do that equation 8 in a Fourier basis. It looks like you have to, it's going to be an infinite thing, but in diagonal 2 by 2 blocks, because the Fourier transform diagonalizes it, just because it's linear constant coefficient. Looks like that. Find zeros of the determinant of that matrix. And so I'm going to draw a picture. And actually, I should have redrawn the slide since my artwork was so bad, but I'm ashamed to say that I'm going to give you the bad artwork. I didn't do it. So this is the null space X1, and you're going to get an element in the null space every time you solve the determinant equals zero for k in the dual lattice to your lattice of translations, because it has to be. So let's visualize it the following way. Let's forget that you have to be in the dual lattice, and let's just look for the zeros of this for all k, and k in R2. And those zeros turn out to be these two big circles. And if surface tension gets smaller, the circles get bigger. When a surface tension is zero, the circles are no longer circles. They're curves that go to infinity. And there is the theorem on finiteness already. Now, where those circles hit a lattice point, that gives you an element in the null space for the periodic problem. And now C, and of course this changes with C, because look, here's a C. So you can imagine there's two parameters. You can always wiggle this around. You can always wiggle it around to get one in there, and you always then carry on wiggling it to get two. But this is a transcendental equation, so nobody's controlling whether you get 10 more. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to call the multiplicity M. That's the number. That 2M is the dimension of the null space. I've drawn multiplicity 4, because 4 here, and there are 4 more. So that's simple. Okay? And then, let me say the result. And then I'll prove the result, more or less. So the result is theorem 4. Suppose that surface tension is positive. Let's make n equals, the dimension equals 3. The spatial dimension equals 3. And let's have the multiplicity of the null space M greater than or equal to 2. Then the theorem is there exists at least m minus 1 distinct critical points Each point, remember, is a critical T2 orbit, because once I have one critical point, I can always translate my origin, get more of H on every non-degenerate manifold M. And so I want to prove the theorem for you, and in particular I want to count YM minus 1, because it'll also tell us how the proof of Weinstein's theorem. Actually, it's tell us about Moser's proof of Weinstein's theorem, to tell you the truth. So, big words, you do some reduced variational problem, and then its equivariant cohomology gives you the count. So I'm going to do both of those, but in really short time. But I think that will suffice. So the space of mappings, well, one, the M, that constraint manifold in the space of mappings, is codimension 2, but it's also unbounded. It's not really so easy to handle. So what I'm first going to do is decompose the space of mappings into two parts, corresponding to the null space and the rest, and with regard to which all mappings can be decomposed and the equations can be decomposed. This is basically classical Lyapunov-Schmidt decomposition. And it turns out X1 is finite dimensional because it's small, no, because surface tension is non-zero, and X2 is the rest of the PDE, and you can solve S2 for S1 and the parameter C. And so that's like solving the P equation, and then you're left to solve the Q equation. It's kind of a standard thing at this point. Oh, and because of that analyticity result, solutions are analytic with respect to the phase space variables, etc. And now I just want to say that the Q equation, well, that's a bona fide equation. But it itself, because of the overall variational character of the problem, it itself has variational formulation. And it goes as follows. You take maps of a torus, T2, to X1, the null space. That's a finite dimensional. Those are mappings from a finite dimensional space to a finite dimensional space. So already it's simpler. And what you do is you constrain it to a submanifold. So that's M sub 1 of A. So it shows S1s here in the null space such that the first momentum of the sum, because that's your solution, is equal to A1, and the X2 momentum of this is also equal to A2. And then the statement is critical points of H1, which is H of this combination, on M1, solve the Q equation, that other equation that we had to solve. And now all I have to do, so you check that. Now all I have to do is decide how to count. So let's do it as follows. So I have this equation, and then we're going to count on the next slide. So for most choices of A, and this is what surprised me. Oh, this is kind of standard-ish, but this is what surprised me. For most choices of this parameter A, which decides the momenta, it's parameterized. A's are essentially are the momentum variables. For most choices of A, the constraint manifold, well, here's M in all mapping space, and here's a null space. So you cut M by the null space, and you get M1, and this is what M1 is. Topologically, it's a product of odd dimensional spheres. That surprised me. And we can talk about it. Topologists in the audience, especially, I'd like to discuss this with, because to me it's a bit mysterious, but that's kind of amazing. And now on that product of spheres, there's that two torus action, because we could translate the origin, just like the one torus that is the circle action of the resonant Lyapunov center theorem. But the two torus action leaves invariant the momenta, so it leaves M1 invariant, and it leaves the H invariant too, so that when we find a critical point, we find a whole torus action of critical points on there. So, therefore, the torus acts on M1, and it respects H. And so what you'd like to say is, well, take M1, you mod the torus action, that's another manifold, you do some more theory in that manifold. In general, it's not a free action, and that quotient is not a manifold. It has points, cusps, multiple points. That's not so good. Nonetheless, this has been the domain of topologists in the subject for quite a long time, and if you question them closely, you learn their secrets. So I'm going to show you the proof of that count M minus 1 in the following slide. So let's do the following thing. I have to count the number of critical points of H on M1. So I'm going to count the number of critical points of any function on M1, which is invariant under T2 action. So critical, and each critical point is a whole orbit. So it's a critical T2 orbits on the manifold M1. And the standard lower bound for that, and let's see, I'm going to say also that there are additive ways of counting critical points, which is sort of what Morse theory is about in general, because you add Betti numbers. But those usually require you to have non-degenerate critical points, so Morse functions. But there are multiplicative ways, which are a little coarser, which don't require non-degeneracy, and in fact, in this case, they give the same answer. So I'm going to give the multiplicative method answer. So that says you have a lower bound by the Lusnik-Schnurlmann category of this thing. And that itself is bounded below by taking the cup length on those product of spheres, but only on forms which are adequately torus action equivariant. And it's the cup length plus 1. And let's just take that estimate to be true. It's a classical estimate. So proposition 5, a general fact about cup length, is that if you have two manifolds and you take their product, then the cup length of that product is the sum of the cup lengths. Well, how do you do it? A cup length is length of the longest differential form that is non-zero class. So you take the longest one in one, the longest one in the other, you wedge them, you get the longest one in both. That's the sum. And then I need a fact. If I have a sphere, mod a circle action, at least in the way that those are modded, and I look at its cup length, it's the same thing as the cup length of the complex projective space of the appropriate dimension, that is P minus 1. And that's equal to P minus 1 by explicit count. Now we go to work. In fact, what I'm going to say is let's cheat. Almost never does our problem have this T2 action free on this product, and it certainly isn't usually, or almost never, is going to be a torus is a circle across a circle, and one circle acting on one, the other circle acting on the other. It's almost never that. In fact, never, never, never. Nonetheless, let's pretend. So I have one circle acting on this, the other circle acting on the other, and we'll get the same answer anyway. And then, if we're in that situation, the critical T2 orbits on M are bigger than or equal to the cup length of this product, mod T2, but in that hypothetical situation, what do you say? I'm using the subjunctive. This circle, one circle acts on this, the other circle acts on that, so it's a complex projective space cross a complex projective space. So that's the cup length, so I'm supposed to add the cup length. Use item 2. P minus 1 plus M minus P minus 1 plus 1 cancel M minus 1. That's the theorem. So, I'm going to stop here. The only other thing I would say is it's a special interest when it's non-resonant. Back to the Lyapunov theorem itself. Never mind poor Alan Weinstein. And there, the structure of solutions has special form. It's like what is a simple bifurcation when bifurcation surfaces are surfaces and when there are two parameters. So it's sort of like multi-parameter simple bifurcation. But I'm finished with my hour, and I don't want to impress anyone. So that's also a lunchtime conversation. So let me stop here.
Questions?
Yes, please.
Sorry, I came in late, but I remember, I don't know if you, from the physics point of view, is that do you ever find sort of solutions where the wave crests do not have equal height?
Oh.
Traveling waves. I remember seeing computations a few years ago by Zuccaria. It was actually, he did sort of a perturbation sort of in the Hamiltonian through higher order in the surface elevation, getting a fourth order or fifth order.
So I'm going to do... Hang on a minute.
There was a slide, and I missed it.
Hang on a minute. You are asking leading questions, although you may or may not believe it. So here's that simple one where all the things are the same height. I didn't intend to talk about this, but I will. But then you go up to the maximum solution, and there's one which alternate ones have. This is the Stokes crest. So not only do they have different height, but you go all the way up to the Stokes crest, and crest, lower, crest, lower. And actually, there's a myriad of bifurcations where you can get lots of patterns, some of them having the Stokes crest, other ones, but in a periodic array, but, you know, 17 aligned where only two of them somewhere are Stokes crest. I wasn't going to talk about that, but thanks for leading on. That's what we'll talk about over lunch, if you would like. And those are 2D. So the 3D ones... Oh, what are the crests like in 3D? Michael, what are the crests like in 3D? I don't know either, but I haven't heard many people who have an opinion. But it'd be interesting to explore. Yeah, we're working on numerics to get up to that. I think there could be a lot of different types of crests. I think they're not very physical because... if you're in 2D, you can enforce 2D, and it's and it loses stability to 3D, but you enforce 2D, and you can get up pretty high. But in 3D, there's a lot more room for instabilities. So I think it's even a less physical question than what happens to a 2D problem up at the crest, but mathematically, intellectually, interesting.
You have a question?
Yes.
Early on, you used the Dirichlet-Neumann operator to handle this Neumann condition on the bottom. Does this allow you to handle different bottom shapes?
Absolutely.
And have you seen the results of...
Well, but you do have to do the following thing. I'm going to put now rocks on the bottom.
Yeah.
And I'm going to look for a traveling wave. You know what the and it has to be stationary as I move and see. You know what happens when it sees a rock? Blip. It's no longer stationary. It depends on time.
All right.
So what you might find is... ones that are moving, well, let me say it the following way. Ones that are that are moving in a, I want to change scale. So ones that are moving in slow time, so it sees the blips, but very, very often, and tries to preserve its average form. And so you average out the bottom in some way. But unfortunately, it forces time dependence if you have too many rocks.
So all the stuff downstream you did, which is... looking for traveling waves just doesn't apply.
Well,
to cases where this.
I take it back a little bit. You can have a stream flowing at a certain speed and encounter a rock at a certain speed and look for a traveling wave in the stream's coordinates at the speed at which the stream is flowing. But you don't. It's not the same parameterization. So you have to move in order to get it. You have to adjust the stream flow, right? But right, kayakers would know that and surf in it, or kayak surf in it. Yes?
Can you say a couple of words about where the small divide would come from? Something I guess you didn't get to at the...
Would you like me to give... I can stand up here and wave my hands in an amusing physical argument. And or I could derive it on the blackboard, and it's your choice.
I guess it depends how patient everyone is.
Amusing physical argument, then.
Okay.
So it comes in two steps. One, my first step, it'll take 2 minutes, which is not too long, but it's long enough that people might be restless, and you can leave, and I'm not insulted. Step one, water wave problem is a hyperbolic system with multiple characteristics. Maybe it's not so obvious, since Laplace's equation is sitting so fully in the center of it. But, okay, we have to derive what the characteristics are. So this is my step one, is... I'm going to derive that fact, that is, I'm going to find the characteristics for you by swimming. Or you have to imagine yourself swimming. So go to the beach, go swimming, but move past the surf, because the surf is going to confuse us, and it's way too nonlinear. And when you're out treading water, out there a little bit, think of the pattern that's around you. And that pattern is... And that pattern is doing the following. So you're treading water, and a wave comes in, the surfers are on it or whatever, and it lifts you up and then sets you down again. That's the long waves. But as it lifts you up and sets you down, it also lifts up a pattern of shorter waves and sets that pattern down. It's a typical thing you see at the beach, right? So lesson we learn is short waves travel slower than long waves. if you forget capillarity, oh, I should have said it's hyperbolic if it's not capillary, if there's no surface tension. If you forget capillarity, and that's what you asked me, zero surface tension, small divisors. If you forget capillarity, there's no point at which the solution, those shorter waves have a minimum speed. It's zero. The shorter it is, the slower it goes till it stops. That's the characteristic. That is the limit of the group velocity is zero and the characteristic is zero. But you can go toward the beach and you can go away to the beach, and those are two waves, and they both stop at zero. So it's a multiple characteristic with a characteristic velocity zero and real. That's hyperbolic, but weakly hyperbolic. Good, that's step one. Step two, a small divisor is 1 over an eigenvalue, and the eigenvalue is small. So an eigenvalue itself is 1 over a period. So I have to look for large periods in the problem. And I'm going to do the linearized equation. I told you it was a hands-waving argument. You have to imagine swimming in, etc. So I have to find large periods in the problem. So I'm going to imagine moving in this direction with C. So now I'm in a frame of reference moving with C. And the small waves, and so there are waves, but my frame of reference is moving. So large waves maybe move with it, maybe move counter to it, but the small waves are kind of trying to stand still. But I'm in this frame of reference, so once every spatial period I see a small wave. That's the period 1 over which is an eigenvalue, and it has fixed period because that's the 2D problem. No small divisors in the 2D problem. In the 3D problem, my frame of reference is moving, my reference frame is moving in this direction, and short waves in this direction almost don't move, so they see that the period of this. But short waves in this direction are constant along here. There's their crest, and they're moving in this direction. And it takes them awful long time to cross the transversal period. That's a long period. 1 over it is the eigenvalue. Small divisors. 2 minutes. I'll derive it for you mathematically.
Any other questions? Okay, so
let's
start.
Thank you again.
Is there a dinner plan for you?
Yeah, if everyone's interested.